Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I thought I'd get into that whole net zero business, and I thought the right person to do that with would be Alex Masters. Alex.
Hello, good afternoon, yes.
Welcome to Brokenomics. Now, we may know you as that Steam guy from Twitter and various other places. Tell us about yourself.
Yes, well, it does turn out I'm actually a real person. Yes, so I'm Alex, that Steam guy. I'm the chairman of an industrial history charity down in Devon called the Robey Trust. Mm-hmm. I potter about making sustainable fuels as part of that, and generally just sort of making myself a nuisance in the community, driving rollers about. But what I really am at heart is a sort of a practical industrial historian, sort of growing up on episodes of Fred Dibner and things like that. Yeah. You know, so really trying to live that up.
And the sort of best of British when we were doing steam
when
things.
When we were doing stuff.
Yes, when we did stuff.
Yeah. You remember stuff?
Well, not in my lifetime.
Yeah.
No, all the stuff was on its way out in my lifetime.
Yeah, you got sort of the last, like the Talbot Sunbeams and things like that and the sort of Triumph Avengers. I didn't even get that.
Yes.
You know,
do you have an Instagram?
No.
But if you did, it would be full of photos of you on the back of steam engines.
Yes, well, I know the Trust itself has an Instagram, which is run by other young people. But because I don't understand it, no, I don't have an Instagram myself.
Right, but you're often on the back of these steam engines.
Oh, yes.
Marching up and down Devon, or is it Devon? Or?
Yeah. Yes, on top of it, in it, under it, you know, back, forward, left, right, all over the place.
And these are the big things that require the shovel full of coal and the toot toot and the
yeah, absolutely,
the big puff. And
Yeah. So we do a lot of that. We're a bit of a weird organisation because a lot of the road steam in this country is owned by sort of individuals and families. It's all really quite lovely when you see, you know, an engine that was bought in 1910 and it stayed in the same family. That tends to be a lot of the agricultural stuff, as it stayed with the family who bought it. A lot of the rollers were built for contractors, so they were sort of bought in job lots, and then in the sort of 60s they were all laid up in a field or scrapped or whatever, and then somebody bought them. We've got one engine in the collection which the chap bought it when he was 18, and he's 81 now and he's still got it. So half its life, he's owned that engine, yeah. And we've got one engine, our like flagship one, Stumbles. She was bought by the town council in 1925, came down on the railways, and has been in the town ever since. You know, so she was part of the Tavistock division, mending potholes around the town, and then she got laid up in the park as a climbing frame in the 60s. And then in the mid-80s, a bunch of people got together and phoned up the council and said, you know, that's full of asbestos, right? And they're, yeah, okay, we suppose you better get rid of it. And I said, well, you know, give it to us and we'll restore it. And they did, and that's really what formed the nexus of the charity. And then once you've got one engine, you know, you get two. And once you've got two, you've got a collection. And then once you've got a collection, people phone you up. And then you start adding bits to it. So it's a collection that's been growing and evolving.
So how big is the collection now?
So the Trust itself owns 1.5 rollers.
Right.
There's another, I think it's 8,
right,
road engines. But then we've got a load of big stationaries, little stationaries. Really interesting bits of kit. We've got engines that were like the test beds in Oxford University. Mm. We've got one that ran the washeries at a lunatic asylum. We've got one that worked in the Watney's brewery making Watney's Red Barrel. We've got all that sort of stuff. And then at that time as well was when they were really chucking all the lathes out of technical colleges because we were living in a post-industrial age or whatever it was.
Oh, yes.
So we were lucky enough to sort of grab all that as it was getting ditched. So we've got a fully equipped machine shop and wood shops and, you know, buckets of tools which now you pay thousands and thousands of pounds for, and they were just chucking it in skips, and it was all wrapped up in grease paper and never used, and sort of now, you know, 40-50 years after it was made, it's finally doing its job, and we're using that really to not only keep the collection going, but we've also got about half a dozen youngsters coming up through it, because I mean I'm already an old man in that sort of scenario, so we're teaching them all the metalworking skills, and machining skills. And we've had lads who've not only gone to university to study engineering. We've got one lad who's currently doing a boilersmithing apprenticeship at the Severn Valley Railway. So working on the really big stuff. And it's really good to see that, you know, we're trying to sort of keep it alive and kindle the embers, as it were.
Because if you're an Anglo, you can't help but like the old steam engines, can you? Because it harks back to an era where the Anglos were truly great and we were doing... I mean, I can imagine if you're like a Californian or something, you're getting all excited about search engines and AIs and stuff like that. But I mean, our moment of pinnacle of doing stuff...
Yeah.
Was the steam engine.
Was really that age. It funnels into all the sort of industrial history stuff and the imperial history where...
Yeah.
You can almost sort of see where Britain, if you were playing Civilization 5, ends up in 20 years like 3 tech levels above everybody else. Mm-hmm. And just ends up, you know, dominating the rest of the world before they've even caught up.
Which kind of is what happened.
It's kind of is what happened, to be honest. And you watch things in Germany and France and all the rest of it, and they keep having to go, and then the Anglos turned up and did it for us because we couldn't do it. Mm. Rather embarrassingly. A great age, yeah, and sadly gone forever.
Yes.
As we covered in our section on regulation.
But you know that gives you, I mean, so you've got a firm appreciation for industrialisation and the evolution of energy and all that kind of stuff. But what we're actually here to talk about is the net zero thing.
Yeah.
Which I kind of have a sense is probably a bigger change than people think and is a bit silly for a number of reasons.
Mm.
What would you say to that?
I think one of the big things about the Industrial Revolution is it was really the first time in history man had ever managed to make energy on demand. So before then, you either did it yourself, got an animal to do it, or waited for the weather, either through a windmill or a water mill. And what the Brits managed to crack was a way of harnessing the stored energy in coal to create limitless power exactly when you wanted
right.
it and exactly where you want it.
Yes.
And once you can do that, you're off to the races. And what net zero does and the technologies that they're trying to use undoes all that. And at the end of the day, if you deindustrialize in that sort of way, not only do you end up with a pre-industrial standard of living, but you end up with a pre-industrial population.
Well, that's kind of what's happening in Germany at the moment, because we may have been first into this glorious new industrial age, but at least we're not the first out. We're probably working quite close behind. But I mean, Germany, of course, with the all the shenanigans with the Russian situation and so on, they've kind of basically divested themselves of an awful lot of energy.
Yeah.
They don't want to use nuclear. They've shut off their cheap gas, which was... I mean, the German economy is basically a 5 trillion euro economy, all based on 50 billion euros worth of cheap Russian energy. And they've just decided, yeah, we're just going to turn that off.
Yeah.
And get rid of our nuclear power stations.
Yeah.
But they're a big industrial nation.
Yeah.
And the collapse in their industrial fortunes has been astonishing.
Yeah. It's really sad to see as well. Mm. Because, yeah, Germany was one of the all-time greats, I think, when it came to industrialisation. You actually see in the history that it's really by about 1880 that sort of Anglo dominance is over. And it's not just... A lot of people go on about the Americans and how the American economy just became so huge because it's a, you know, basically an island that's 3,000 miles across. But actually, you get into the sort of late 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, all of a sudden, all the inventions are coming from Germany. It's in that period the Germans dominate. They get very, very early on board with the electrical industry, you know, Bosch, Siemens, people like that. They obviously invent the motor car with Gottlieb Daimler and Benz. They also get massively into the petrochemicals industry.
So and they still are. Something like 15% of the German economy is chemicals, or at least it was, because chemicals is a very energy intensive business.
Yeah. And it's all those basic chemical processes, you know, the Fritz Haber process and all the, they've all got German names because they were all developed by Germans before World War One.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a reason why in Breaking Bad, when he goes off to get those chemicals, he's getting them from a German company. It's they are predominant. Well, they were, and they're rapidly divesting themselves of it. So, I mean, they did that through a process of basically believing the neocons' propaganda and sort of divesting themselves of it in a very short time period. Mm. But we are in hock to this net zero ideology. Why are we doing that?
I think, ultimately, mankind has to have an apocalyptic myth. And I don't want to sound too much like Peterson or anything like that, but it always used to be religion. We then destroyed that. So, but we needed something else. There had to be some great, you know, you got rid of religion, then it was the Soviet Union, so you had mutually assured destruction and things like that. And then you end up with the end of history, and now the neocons need something else. They've decided that history's over, and they need some great unifying narrative to bring everything together. You can't just use liberal democracy. It's too, you've got it already, and it's too sort of ephemeral. That sort of,
they need a them and us kind of thing. Always.
And they need some great evil.
I'm not sure the right does that, because I don't feel the need to have some apocalyptic event in the future. I'm just quite happy getting on with stuff.
Well, I think the apocalyptic event on the right is probably demographic collapse and demographic change.
Yeah. But, I mean, you can just breed your way out of that if you make an effort.
And net zero as well. It's also a very, very useful tool for international control. The atmosphere is global. You know, the CO2 doesn't respect borders, as all the rest of things like this. But there's also our entire economy is based on carbon fuels, renewables or not. It's all based around the oil industry, the coal industry. It's all based around steel making and concrete and all the rest of it. Every single thing you do as an industrial and post-industrial economy is based on carbon dioxide. Even being human beings, you know, when we respire, it's carbon dioxide and water.
There's subsistence farming, and then there's carbon energy and everything else.
Yeah.
But it all stems from carbon energy.
Yeah. So what it means is that as things like carbon taxes and that, you get to put your ore into absolutely everything.
Yes.
Absolutely everything.
So if we're trying to understand the scale of the net zero change, what you're essentially telling me is it's kind of an everything change.
Yeah. You can get into a debate about whether or not they're conscious that the post-war consensus is breaking down. And what they're trying to do is a sort of, they're controlling the demolition of that on one side, the petrodollar-based international world order. They're trying to sort of collapse that down and then feed in the replacement paradigm. And the replacement paradigm is going to be this sort of net zero cybersecurity utopia. But there's no, one of the things that I really struggle with understanding the net zero zealots is their sort of what comes next. There isn't really a positive vision. They just sort of, they keep going on about green jobs. Yeah. And it's like, but energy manufacturing is the absolutely basics of an industrial economy. You know, the first thing you do is you mine coal. Then you do interesting stuff with it.
So the line I have on that, which I always use, is the base tier of any economy is energy and agriculture.
Yeah.
And those are the two things that you do not, under any circumstances, export. Because everything else stems from that. If you want to do, we're doing hairdressing and washing machines, well, you can swap that out. You can decide, this week we're going to do tumble dryers and nail clippings or whatever the hell it is. Everything else you can swap, but energy and agriculture, you must have that.
Yeah, you could also probably put mining and fishing in there. So the sort of resource collection industries, your absolute base tier, you know, playing on your game, what's the first thing you do is you make sure you've got a decent supply of food, wood and gold.
Yes.
And that's the absolute foundational stuff. And it's because it's the absolutely foundational stuff, that's why they're obsessed with it.
Okay, so break this down into some sort of examples. What kind of things are we witnessing that's heralding this change?
We're witnessing things like the carbon exchange mechanisms in the EU and sort of playing with it here.
Okay.
There's a lot of things around. I mean, your car tax is based on emissions, and they're only supposed emissions as well. They're not done on, miles driven or anything like that, which I ultimately believe is what they're going to go for. They're going to the sensible thing to do would be to tax you based on your odometer readings at your MOT. What they're actually going to do is stick a black box in your car so they can tax you in real time. They can also issue speeding fines in real time, of course, as well.
Yes. Especially with the CBD.
Yeah. You see it in the price of petrol. It's something like 88p a litre is tax. And that's not just VAT, that's all the taxes on top of that. But it ultimately manifests as prices in the shops, because unless you grew it yourself, it has been made somewhere by somebody using energy and then transported somewhere by somebody using energy. There is this, they know the current paradigm is unsustainable.
Yeah.
And I think what they're trying to do is they're blaming the unsustainability on fossil fuels. Because the last thing they want to do is blame it on themselves. They don't want to blame it. We live in a debt-based system with collapsing birth rates, which is eating through social and cultural capital at such a massive rate of knots that society... No. It's because everybody drives petrol cars.
Yeah, I mean, and also just the sheer geography of it. Because if you look at the places... And in fact, the Davos, the WEF, they outline this in their... possibly 2022 Davos report. They sort of put out this document that said, okay, well, look, obviously we have to do net zero. I mean, that's just, they talk past the sale. Yeah. That's a given. And then they said, okay, well, where is the stuff that lets us do the net zero? And basically it's all in China and Russia.
Yes.
So Russia has vast amounts of commodities and resources. I mean, they quite often just have the absolute monopoly on a lot of stuff, and China also has the monopoly on a whole bunch of rare earth metals and stuff.
Yeah.
So you can't do the net zero without the Russia and the China.
Yes.
Just so happens that we are desperately trying to find a way of breaking Russia up into five smaller states that can be more easily managed by the global order, and they haven't quite got around to tackling China yet. But they need that stuff from there. And then in the meantime, between how we get between then and now, well, you still do need the carbon. And where's that? Well, that's all in, Middle East.
Yeah.
Venezuela has some, but they're such a basket case at the moment, it's difficult to
do anything with it. Yeah, can't really get it out of there, yeah.
We do have some, but for whatever reason, we've chosen not to extract it because, obviously that'd be too easy or something.
Yeah.
So, the WEF report kind of made it very clear that that's where the stuff is. We need to get it. How are we going to get it? And they were a bit vague about that, but they did say, well, there's probably going to have to be some war and conflict and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's one of those things. It was always, I remember back in the sort of 2010s, there was, that everybody's favourite conspiracy theory was that it was going to be a massive global conflict over water. Which seems to have died a death, actually. But access to rare earths and a lot of it seems to be the sort of magic tech and the sort of visioneering where they say, oh, yeah, what we're going to do is we're going to mine comets. And it's like, for rare earths, and you go, no, that's just...
Yeah, let's get through some interim stages first.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that will happen at some point.
Crank it up to 11, yeah. We're going to interplanetary yes. star flight so you can have solar panels on your roof. And it's like... there's one or two steps before that, Chief. I think you need to have a proper look at. But ultimately, it's the... I think they sort of ran the basic model with the petrodollar.
Yeah.
And now they want to electrify that. Yeah. Because it gives them far more options. And actually, one of the things with renewables that they're constantly talking about is your ability to... A lot of the times they market it as an energy security thing. And it's really interesting to say sort of, and they go, oh, well, we can put offshore wind in the North Sea. And you go, okay. But again, it comes back to the rare earth thing. Well, where does all the copper come from that goes in the in the turbines and things like that. And the solar panels, most of them are made in China, you know, by slave labor, basically. And
yeah, that's
I think that one of the things they've got is a very Whiggish view of technology, where they seem to think, they go, right, you've got an agrarian economy, then you have an industrial one, then you have a post-industrial one, then we'll have the net zero utopia. And that sort of, there's no inkling in them that to get to that, you've got to have all the rest of it.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.